Martial law has been proclaimed in this town. These two men have been condemned to death under the rules of martial law. They have been convicted and condemned for stealing vital medication, painkillers, from Miller's nursing home, leaving the residents there to suffer in agony. Of that crime and the general crime of looting, they have been found guilty beyond all reasonable doubt at a fair and open hearing.
"Fuck your trial," Larry screamed. "This is a lynch mob."
John was silent, and no one from the crowd replied. There were no shouts or taunts. "I am a citizen of this town," he said, his voice now softer. "By tradition, even in times of martial law, our police, who directly enforce the law, will not participate in what will now happen, nor our governing body. I want all of you to understand that. This is not a police state, and it never will be. The condemned were found guilty at a fair hearing, and the sentence will now be carried out, not by those who are temporarily in charge of law and order, but by two duly appointed citizens who have volunteered for this task." He lowered his head and swallowed, knowing he could not let a tremor get into his voice. "I do not want this task. I did not seek it. I loathe doing it." He paused. "But it must be done." He paused again for a moment, realizing something more still had to be said. "We are all Americans here. There are hundreds of you, perhaps thousands, who did not live here but 5 days ago." Again a brief pause. "But you do now. All of us are equal under the eyes of the law here. All of us. We must work together as neighbors if we wish to survive. The tragic justice to be dealt out here is the same for all of us, whether born here, moved here as I did some years ago, or arrived just yesterday. It must be the same for all of us." His voice trailed off. Nervously, he looked back at the two guilty men, Reverend Black holding Bruce up with one hand, open Bible in the other. Larry, still held by Tom, his eyes glazed from the drugs and with a boiling hatred. John wondered now just how legal, how close to law in the tradition of Western civilization his act and his words truly were. But he felt they were right, right for here, this moment, if the people of Black Mountain were to survive as a community. He fell silent and looked over at Charlie. There was a pause until Charlie realized that ritual demanded that he say something. He stepped in front of the group.
"By the power vested in me by emergency decree by the civilian government of this community, the town of Black Mountain, now under local martial law, I have found Larry Randall and Bruce Wilson guilty of looting of medical supplies and in so doing causing pain, suffering, and death. Their sentence is death by firing squad, to now be carried out by Dr. John Matheson and Mr. Washington Parker, appointed by me to perform this task."
Charlie looked over at John, nodding. John turned to face the condemned, his hand shaking.
"Remember what I said. First shot to the chest, let him drop, then empty the rest of the clip, last one in the head," Washington whispered.
The two walked the few dozen feet to the prisoners. Tom stepped back and away from Larry, who glared at him with cold hatred. But Reverend Black did not move, holding Bruce up.
"I think we should pray," Reverend Black said.
And John nodded in agreement, embarrassed that he had not thought to do so. Still holding Bruce, Reverend Black looked to the crowd.
"I ask God, in his divine mercy, to grant forgiveness to these two. But we must now render unto Caesar the law of Caesar. Forgiveness and redemption now rest between Bruce, Larry, and their Creator. Bruce, do you ask God for forgiveness?"
"Yes, please, God, please forgive me."
"Larry?"
He was silent.
"Our Father, who art in heaven."
John repeated the prayer, hoping that the trembling of his hands would stop.
He looked at Larry, making eye contact. There was nothing but rage there, blind animal rage, and John almost felt pity. "For thine is the kingdom, the power, the glory, forever and ever. Amen." The last word, "Amen," echoed from the crowd. John shifted the Glock to his left hand and for the first time in years made the sign of the cross. Then he shifted the pistol back. Reverend Black stepped away from Bruce, who now struggled to make a show of standing up straight. John suddenly realized there should have been something, blindfolds, sacks over their heads. "Now, get it done. Get it done quick."
"Move closer," Washington whispered. "Fire, and I'll fire with you."
John looked straight at Larry, who was now only 10 feet away.
"Go ahead, do it," Larry said coldly.
It all seemed to move so slowly. Without ceremony, flourish, John raised the pistol, centered it on the man's chest. At the very last instant, Larry started to move to try to fall to one side. John squeezed the trigger. He saw the impact. Larry staggered backwards against the concrete wall. The roar of Washington's .45 exploded next to him, startling him. He saw his second shot miss, striking above Larry's head as he slid down against the wall, leaving a bloody streak. Two more quick shots from Washington's .45. John fought to center his Glock, aimed at Larry's midsection. He was kicking feebly. John could hear screams behind him. He fired again, again, and then again. A hand was on his shoulder. It was Washington.
"The head," Washington said softly.
John walked up to Larry. Was he dead? Blood was pooling out under his body, the front of his pants wet, another stench added in, bladder and bowels having let go. There seemed to be a flicker of eye movement. John aimed at the center of Larry's head, standing over him, and fired. A second later, another explosion, the coup de grace being delivered to Bruce. Woodenly, John turned. All were now staring at him, all silent, hands to mouths. A few were crying. The way they looked at him, it was different, different from anything he had ever seen before in the eyes of people gazing at him. Fear, awe, revulsion. From a few strange glazed eyes, almost a look of envy and lust. He felt the vomit coming up. He had to control it. He held the Glock up, not sure if he had actually emptied it or not. His student Jeremiah was standing in the crowd, and John made eye contact. Jeremiah stepped forward, and John handed him the gun. "Secure the gun and meet me at the car," John whispered. He turned and walked away from the crowd, got behind the concrete wall, bent double, and vomited. Gasping, he remained doubled over.
"It's okay, sir."
It was Washington. John looked up at him, suddenly ashamed.
"Puked my guts out the first time I killed a man. Sir, if you hadn't, I'd have been worried about you."
"Stop calling me sir, goddammit," John hissed between the continuing heaves.
"You did the right thing, sir. You did it well."
"Well? How can you say killing a man like that was done well?"
"No, sir. Not that. It's always a stinking mess. I mean what you said. That's why I call you sir now. We used to joke about it before. Frankly, sir, you were a professor type, but I knew you were a colonel, so I played along. But today, sir, you led out there. You faced something horrible. And you led."
"Okay," John sighed.
"Come on, let's get out of here."
John nodded, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. He winced with pain. His finger was infected, and the act of shooting the Glock had ripped the cut wound open. He came back around the wall, and the crowd, mysteriously, was all but gone. Few had hung around. The bodies were gone. Bartlett's van already driving off. John realized he must have been behind the wall for long minutes. He was glad no one was around to see him now. A bit wobbly, he headed for his car.
John?
It was Michaela. He didn't recognize her at first. Gone was the sexy business suit. She had on a pair of baggy jeans, a few sizes too big, and an old faded T-shirt from Purdue University.
Thank you, John.
For what, damn it?
What you said back there before you had to shoot those two.
He nodded.
It's been getting a little tense between those who lived here before and people like me who have wandered in. What you said needed to be said. It reminded us we're one in this.
Okay. He really did not want to talk, and he slowly continued to the car.
Let me look at that hand.
She stepped around in front of him, and he winced as she pulled the bandage off.
John, it's getting infected, badly infected. I told you to go home, wash it, and keep it protected.
He thought of the nursing home, carrying his father-in-law, the filth there.
I need to clean that up for you, John. It really should be stitched up.
It can wait, he said woodenly. I just want to go home now.
Okay, then. I'll go with you.
He glared at her coldly, a sick thought crossing his mind that perhaps she was turned on to him because of what he had just done, that, or as an outsider, she was ingratiating herself with a man who now obviously had power in the town. She stepped back slightly.
John, first you're getting an infection. In this situation you could lose your hand or maybe even your life. Second, I heard about your father-in-law and the nursing home. I volunteered to go up there to help clean and take care of the folks. After I'm done with you, it's a far shorter walk. Third, John, your little girl. Jennifer, isn't it?
Yes.
Monitoring her diet now is going to be tough. She should be checked every couple of days by a nurse or doctor. So just take me home with you. I'll get done what needs to be done and then go up to the nursing home for the night.
Okay. It was all he could say. He got to the car, Washington and the two boys standing by it.
Jeremiah handed the Glock back to John. It's cleared and empty, sir. Tom gave me a fresh clip. You'll find it in your glove compartment.
Washington took the AR-15 and the two shotguns out of the vehicle.
We'll walk back to campus, sir. Why don't you just go home?
Phil stepped around and opened the door for Michaela, who got in. John looked back to the blood-splattered wall, and then, almost ironically, 50 yards beyond it, the flagpole, and the flag floating atop it. The sky beyond it was darkening, a late-afternoon thunderstorm building. He thought of Jeremiah's question and wondered,
"Can we still keep this as America? Are we still America?"
As he drove home, he did not say a word.
"Vomited, didn't you?"
she finally said, breaking the silence.
"Yeah." "I thought you were a soldier."
"I am. I mean, I was. Not many soldiers, though, are trigger pullers. I was in Desert Storm, exec for a battalion with the 1st Cav. Saw fighting from a distance, but never actually pulled a trigger. Most of the time I was just hunched over a computer screen trying to direct the action."
"Sorry, that came out wrong," Michaela replied. "I didn't mean it as an insult. It's just the way you handled that guy in the drugstore the other day. You struck me as someone who had seen combat before."
"No."
"It's all right.
I still get queasy at times during an operation. I damn near died when I walked into that nursing home last evening." "Thanks for doing that."
"My job now, I guess."
The conversation died away. They pulled into the driveway. The two fools, Ginger and Zack, came running up, and at the sight of a stranger they showed typical golden retriever loyalty and went running straight to her, ignoring John. She laughed, scratching their ears as they jumped up to lick her, both starting to bark as they danced around her. John headed for the door where Jen stood.
"Thank God you're home," Jen said. "What happened? I've been worried sick all day about you."
"Went to Asheville, like I told you."
She looked past John to Michaela, who was coming up, the dogs trailing beside her.
Jen's eyes widened slightly, and John could sense she was not pleased that this woman was an invader in her territory. "Mom, I'd like you to meet Michaela Turner. Michaela, this is my mother-in-law, Jennifer Dobson." The two nodded and shook hands. "Mom, you might recall Michaela. She was the woman on the road the first evening."
Oh, yes. My dear, I didn't recognize you, given how you are dressed now."
"She's a nurse, Mom. Head RN with a surgical unit, actually. She came here to check on Tyler, Jennifer, and this." He held up his hand. Jen's talons retracted, and there was a smile.
"Oh, come on in, dear."
"How is Tyler?" John asked.
"Resting comfortably," she said quietly.
"The girls?"
"Jennifer's taking a nap. Her sugar level was up, and she just took a shot. Elizabeth is out for a walk with Ben."
"Fine." John walked into his office and left the two women, who went straight to what was now Tyler's sick room. John took the Glock out from his belt, looked at it, and laid it on his desk. He noticed now that the smell of cordite hung heavy on it, and on him. Reaching around to the back corner of the desk, he pulled out a dust-covered bottle. There had been several times in his life when drinking had damn near won out, the last time for several weeks after Mary died. The dust on the bottle was a reassurance. He poured a double scotch out into an empty coffee cup and drained it down in two gulps. The thunderstorm that had been on the western horizon rolled in, rain slashing against the window. A soothing sound. When Michaela came into the room a half hour later to check his hand, he was fast asleep.
Chapter 6 Day 10
"John, you look like crap warmed over."
He nodded, walking into the conference room for what had now become their daily meeting.
"Thanks, Tom. I needed that."
In spite of Michaela's attention, John's hand was still infected, and he was running a fever of just over 100.5. He settled into what was now his chair at the middle of the table. Interesting how quickly habits form regarding a meeting. Sit in a chair once, and the following day that's where you sit again. Symbolism of who sits at the foot and head of the table the same. Kate still held that symbolic position at the head, but it was actually Charlie now, sitting to her right, who ran the morning briefing, Tom at the foot of the table. Doc Keller had become part of the team as well, sitting across from John. Two more were present. He didn't recognize either. One dressed in a police uniform, a Swannanoa Police Department badge stitched on his sleeve. The second man in jeans and T-shirt, both in their mid-40s. John picked up the cup of coffee that was waiting for him with his left hand.
"Let me look at that,"
Keller said, getting out of his chair and coming around the table. He eased back the surgical gauze that Michaela had redressed the wound with the evening before.
"Good stitching job. Couldn't have done better myself."
John said nothing. The dozen stitches Michaela had sewed had been done without any painkiller, other than a swig of a scotch, and he had sweated that out silently, though he had cursed a bit when she had closed the wound with alcohol. Keller leaned over and sniffed the bandage and shook his head.
"How did it get infected like this?"
"I think when I was carrying my father-in-law at the nursing home."
"Treatment?"
"Michaela Turner, the nurse who volunteered to help run the nursing home, she put me on Cipro. Got some from the nursing home."
"Most likely fecal contact,"
Keller said, nodding and looking at the wound.
"But you can also get some pretty tough strains of bacteria and viruses growing, even in the cleanest hospital or home. Strep or staph."
"Let's talk about this later," Keller said and went back to his seat. Kate cleared her throat.
"Okay, let's get started. We got a new problem. Dr. Keller, would you lead off?"
The old town doc nodded.
"We've got an outbreak of salmonella at the refugee center in the elementary school. It was bound to happen. I've got at least 100 sick over there this morning. A mess. Damn mess.
How did it get started? Kate asked.
Keller looked at her with surprise. Hell, Kate, people are used to running water, hundreds of gallons a day. Foods with dates stamped on it. One day over the limit and we used to throw it out. There's 600 people camped there. At least we still have enough water pressure for the toilets to flush, but no hot water. And to be blunt, no toilet paper or paper towels as well. It's getting nasty. Come on, people, think about it. Most of us haven't bathed in 10 days. Toilet paper's getting scarce. Soup line meals twice a day at the refugee center. Food now of real questionable safety. I'll bet that damn near every person in there will be crapping their guts out and puking by the end of the day. He sighed. 7 dead this morning. I checked before coming over here. 2 of them infants, the rest elderly. Dehydrated out and couldn't get electrolytes into them fast enough. I'll need more volunteers to go down there to help out, because it will be full-blown by the end of the day. No one spoke. The thought of a school building full of people in that condition, it left the rest in the room silent.
Remember Katrina and that god-awful superdome? Charlie sighed. Is that what we got?
Worse, Keller replied. Screwed up as their administration was, ultimately help was on the way, even though a lot of people started to panic with insane reports of murder and rape. We don't have that here at all, but on the other side, the cavalry is not going to come rushing in with helicopters loaded with supplies. We are on our own. We need to get some clean vats for sterile water. We can mix up an electrolyte batch like what is used in emergency relief in third world countries.
We are a friggin' third world country now, the police officer from Swannanoa said softly.
It's simple enough. Just pure water. We still have that, don't we, Charlie?
What is coming out, gravity-fed, from the reservoir is still clean, at least as of the last time our water department people tested it, yesterday.
I worry about that.
All you need are some folks camping around the reservoir. One of them has a bug and relieves himself by the lake, and all of us are sick.
Charlie looked over at Tom. We better get a few men up there patrolling the lake. No campers.
The fishing in the lake was one of the more poorly guarded secrets of the community across the years. The reservoir, shared with Asheville, was supposedly strictly off-limits to everyone, even before all this had started. But many were the kids who would sneak in there with a rod and pull out a trophy brown trout of 10 pounds or more. Until an activist type in Asheville had blown the whistle on it 6 years back, there was even a private fishing cabin in the woods just above the lake. A secret retreat for the higher-ups in Asheville and Black Mountain. A good old boys' club for a weekend of drinking and catching damn big trout on what they saw as their private lake. Chances now were that people were already looking to that lake as a source of food, and it would have to be stopped.
We need to mix up a batch of several 100 gallons of clean water, mixture of salt and sugar. It'll keep the electrolyte balance. Then start pouring it down the throats of those poor people. In 9 out of 10 cases, they'll just be damn sick for a few days and then pull through.
And the 10th case? Charlie asked. Keller sighed.
Without IVs, the elderly, children under a year, people already weak from other diseases.
He paused and looked at the ceiling for a moment.
I'll estimate 30 dead, maybe 50 by tomorrow night.
Charlie folded and unfolded his hands.
"Who will organize the volunteers?"
Charlie asked. John sighed.
"I'll go up to the campus, see if we can roust out some kids.
Promise them a damn good meal at the end of it," Charlie said. "One of my men got a deer last night. I got it hidden. Venison steak dinner in exchange for a day's work. I doubt if they'll be hungry after what we're throwing them into, but I'll see," John said.
Keller nodded.
Have them report to me by noon, right here. I'll have to brief them on their own safety before they go over there.
John nodded.
Okay, that brings me to something we might not want to talk about, Charlie said, but I think we should. Burying the dead.
We bury them as we always have, don't we?
Kate asked. There's no cemetery within town limits. The nearest one is over 2 miles away. I'm starting to think long-term here, people. Not just this case with the salmonella, but across the next several months. No one replied. I'm thinking the town golf course across the street from the park.
What?
Tom replied.
That's crazy. You're talking about the golf course?
Exactly. It's within an easy walk of the center of town. There was a lot of grading done when it was built, all of it saw. Easy to dig. The approach up to the sixth green, that's all graded soil, half a dozen feet deep or more. Remember, there's no more backhoes to dig graves, it's back to shovels, and I want graves dug deep and quick.
Damn it, Charlie, that's the town golf course,
Tom interjected. As if anyone is going out today to do 18 holes, Charlie replied sharply. Hell, even you only play with an electric cart. I think we need a cemetery in close by, not out on the other side of Allen Mountain. Doc, do you agree?
Keep it at least a couple of 100 feet back from the creek that feeds into the park, on the slope draining away from the creek.
Yes, I agree.
Then that's where we take the dead now. John remained silent. It was interesting how different things, different changes, shocked in different ways. Tom was a golf addict, regardless of what was now happening, to turn his favorite piece of real estate into a cemetery. It was too much for him to absorb at this moment.
We should get some of the ministers in to consecrate the ground, Kate said. Folks will want that.
Charlie noted it down on his pad. I'll talk to Reverend Black. He's sort of heading up the ministers here now.
Any other health issues? Charlie continued. 4 more deaths up at the nursing home last night. They're dying off quick up there.
John thought of Michaela. She had pretty well taken over the running of the place, and he had not seen her in 2 days now.
3 suicides as well. The McDougals and one of the outsiders.
Greg and Fran? Kate asked in shock.
A neighbor heard the gunshots. Greg had shot Fran, then himself. They left a note. She had cancer, you know. She knew what she was facing without her twice-weekly treatments up in Asheville, so she asked Greg to end it for her. Then he did himself as well. Note said for us to use her remaining painkillers for someone who still has a chance of living.
They sang in the church choir with me, Kate said softly,
and for a moment her features reddened as she struggled to hold back her tears. No one spoke. I'll post the notice about the golf course becoming the cemetery as of today and for the duration of the emergency, Charlie said, finally breaking the silence. Several large whiteboards had been dragged over from the elementary school and tacked to the outside wall of the police station. This was now the official emergency notice board.
We've got dozens of others who I suspect will not last much longer, Keller continued. Those with pancreatic enzyme disorder, the day they run out of pills they start dying. A lot of our severe coronary problems are gone now. Garth Watson dropped dead last night just hauling a bucket of water back up to his house.
Damn, he was only 43, Kate said.
And 50 pounds overweight with cholesterol of 280, Keller said. I warned him. Well, so much for too much fast food. We got over 100 people in town, though, on chemo or radiation therapy for cancer. Their prognosis, well, we saw what happened with Fran. God forgive her, but a lot might decide to take that way out, especially those on serious pain management. We've forgotten what a nightmare the final months of cancer can be like without readily available morphine.
He paused and looked around the room.
I think we have to discuss that right now, he said. We have a limited supply of pain meds. Do we impound it and use it only for emergency situations, or do we continue to let those who are terminal, anyhow, use up what's left?
My God, Doc, Tom interjected. What in hell are you saying? One of those people you are talking about is my aunt.
I know, Keller said softly. God help me, I know. But your Aunt Helen is going to die soon, we know that. But suppose I get a kid in here that needs major surgery. Shock and trauma kill, and managing the pain might mean the difference between his living and dying. We got to think of that.
You're talking triaging the dying off, aren't you, Doc? John said quietly. Keller looked at him and then slowly nodded his head.
I'm not ready for that decision, Charlie sighed. Most of the folks in question still have some meds in their homes. We'll cross that one later. But we'll have to cross it, Keller replied, head half lowered. No one spoke for a moment.
Accidents. You would not believe how many we got, Tom finally said, breaking the silence. Cars are no longer killers, but chainsaws still working, axes, shovels. Joe Peterson damn near cut his own leg off with a chainsaw last night trying to cut firewood. We had 3 accidental gunshot wounds yesterday, one of them fatal, by idiots now walking around armed.
It's food, though, that I think we got to start getting serious about, Keller said.
So what in hell do you suggest that we do different? Charlie replied sharply, and John could sense the tension, as if this had been argued about before the meeting.
By our estimate, Keller replied, we have enough food on hand to feed everyone for another 7 to 10 days. That means using meat any health inspector 2 weeks ago would have condemned. Charlie, after that?
Then what?
Charlie sighed and wearily shook his head. In spite of the fever and chills, John found himself focusing intently on this man who, after 10 days of crisis, 10 days most likely with not more than 3 or 4 hours sleep a night, was approaching collapse.
Half rations, John said quietly.
Charlie looked at him and then nodded. I don't know if that will work with some things, Keller replied. Meat that is beginning to spoil, for example. Dairy products.
Then pass that out now. Use it up. If need be, have a gorge feast tonight with the remaining meat that might be going bad. Just make sure it is cooked until it's damn near like leather. Then anything preserved goes to half rations.
What about those holed up in their houses with food? Keller asked.
Charlie, there's at least 6 houses with electricity, old generators that were unplugged and survived. Enough juice to run a freezer. The Franklin clan, for example, up on the North Fork, I bet they're sitting on 250,000 of meat in their basement freezer.
And you want that I should go get it?
Keller nodded.
Charlie looked at Tom.
I doubt that will work with the Franklins, Tom said, shaking his head. At least with them and all my men being alive once we got the meat. Up in these hills, we have more than a few of the old survivalist types, the kind that were real disappointed that the world didn't go to hell with Y2K. They're just waiting for us to come up and try.
Let it go for now, John said. If we start turning into Stalinist commissars, hunting out every stock of grain and ounce of meat for the collective, you know, the fragile balance we have right now will break down, and it will be every man for himself. And like any collectivization, whether true or not, the rumors will explode that we took the food. But now some animals are more equal than others.
What? Tom asked.
You slept through Mr. Quincy's 9th grade English class, Tom, Kate said. Orwell, Animal Farm. Read it sometime.
Besides, John continued, even if we looted the Franklins clean, that would be enough food to maybe give 600 people one meal. It isn't worth the blowback, and in my opinion is a dangerous political and legal precedent. We don't want to be turning on each other at a time like this. Hell, if anything, we want people like that Franklin clan working alongside of us. If they're survivalists, like you say, and we don't threaten them, maybe they got skills they'll teach to us.
Tom breathed a sigh of relief. I think it's fair that food we salvaged from the stores now belongs to the community. But what people have in their homes, whether it's 1 day left or 6 months' worth, that's theirs.
John looked around the table, and there were nods of agreement. He only wished that Charlie had acted faster, or for that matter that he had thought about it and pushed him to seize control of all food in the town on day 1. If they had done so, and it was rationed out correctly, it might have been enough to stretch at half rations for 2 months or more. But that was too late now.
"What about farms, though?" Kate said.
"I can tell you right now, Kate," Tom said, "and you grew up here, too, and should realize it. The old farms are nearly all gone. When something like this hits, everyone seems to think people living in rural areas are up to their ears in food ready to be given away. But even the farmers now are dependent on the supermarkets, at least until harvest time. Up in the North Fork, we have half a dozen small farms, one with about 60 head of cattle on it, maybe a couple of hundred pigs, usual mix of chickens, turkeys, some geese.
Still, Kate said, stretched, that could be another month or so of food.
I think we have to take that, Charlie said. It's different from what's in people's basements.
John sighed and realized he had to agree, even though it wasn't much different from his commissar imagery of a few moments ago. 60 cattle, 2 or 3 a day turned into soup, stew, could stretch things. But far more pragmatic, how to keep control. To prevent someone else from rustling them, from raiding the farm one night, killing the owners, and then just slaughtering what they could drag away quickly, leaving the rest to rot. Again a film image, from Dances with Wolves, the Indians finding the hundreds of buffalo slaughtered by white hunters who just took their hides and tongues, leaving the rest to rot. It could be the same here. And yet again it caught him how movies had so defined so much of the country's image of self, and now the screens were blank. A movie about us 50 years from now, if there are movies, what will it show?
Charlie, we have to make a deal with a few farmers in this valley. We just can't go marching up there, take their cattle, and ride off. A deal. We protect their food. They get more than a fair cut because they are sharing with the rest of the community. In exchange, we protect them, their herd and crops. And, Charlie, we have to keep some stock alive.
What do you mean?
For next year. A couple of males, enough females. We might be looking at next year, and we're still in the same boat. We gotta keep breeding stock alive, even if it means we go hungry now. In the old days, eating your breeding stock was the final act of desperation.
John, Kate said, I don't need to hear this now. Are you saying this will still be going on a year from now?
Maybe. And if we don't plan now, there won't be a next year for any of us.
Okay, John, Charlie said.
We'll go up to the North Fork later today and start talking.
And suppose someone up there, shotgun in hand, tells us to go to hell and get off his land? Kate asked. You said I grew up here. I did. And I know some of these folks. They're good people, but they don't hold much truck with someone telling them what to do.
Then maybe you should be the one to go talk with them, John said quietly.
Me?
Exactly. Everyone in town knows you, Kate. Even more than they know Charlie or Tom here. You going first would be non-threatening.
Because I'm mayor or because I'm a woman?
She asked sharply.
Frankly, Kate, it's both. Tom shows up, gun on his hip, it's commissar time. You show up, sit down with the family, have a chat. I think you can help folks with these small farms to see reason. They have to strike a deal, because if they stay on their own, sooner or later someone will go for them and take what they have. We promise to post 24-hour guards in their places. We offer protection. They trade some food back to the community.
Sounds a bit like where you come from originally, up in New Jersey, Charlie said with a trace of a smile. Protection racket.
John tried to smile in spite of his lightheadedness.
Like it or not, that's the way it is now. I'm dead set against people's homes being cleaned out, but I think we can agree that farms have to be protected, but something given back in return to help the entire community.
She nodded in agreement.
Okay, I'll go.
Charlie looked down at his notepad.
Transportation. Anything new?
We got 3 more cars running, Tom said.
Actually, I should say that Jim Bartlett down in that Volkswagen junkyard of his did. Beetles. Another van?
He's become a regular friend of yours, Kate said, and there was, at least for a moment, a touch of a smile.
Yeah, damn old hippie.
though I'm not buying his line that we should be using pot for medicine.
I might agree with him now, Keller said. It's breaking the law, Tom replied sharply.
The cars, Tom, Kate interjected. Let's stick with that.
All right. Other garages say they can get 10 or 15 more old junkers up and going, including an old tractor-trailer down at Younger's.
We'll have 40 or 50 within the week, the policeman from Swannanoa said quietly.
No one spoke, looking at him.
You folks up here in Black Mountain always kind of looked down on us in Swannanoa. Maybe because we was poorer. But that poorness makes us worth more now.
John smiled at that and knew it was true. He could remember Tyler calling Swannanoa a poor white trash town, with its trailer parks, auto junkyards, a town that had essentially gone to hell ever since the big woolen and blanket mill closed down years ago. What had once been a thriving small downtown area in Swannanoa was all but abandoned, especially after the big mill burned several years ago. Route 70, which went straight through Swannanoa, was lined with aging strip malls, thrift shops, and repair shops. It was finally starting to turn around, at least until last week, as more and more outsiders came in looking for land with the spectacular views the region offered. The area north of the town was developing with high-priced homes, but that was now a tragic loss. Half a dozen old farms had been chopped up into McMansion estates over the last few years. In the old trailer parks, there were a lot of cars that a week before anyone in a Beamer or a new SUV would have given a wide berth to on the interstate. Some of those rolling heaps were now worth 100 Beamers.
Folks, this is Carl Irwin, Tom interjected. Chief of Police for Swannanoa. I invited him here today to talk about a proposal we have.
Everyone nodded politely. Carl definitely had their attention with Tom's last statement.
And the proposal is? Kate asked.
An alliance.
John smiled. Again, the historian in him, picturing kings of the ancient world, riding to a meeting in chariots to discuss water rights, the exchange of daughters, to band their armies together.
Carl and I have been talking about this for days, Tom interjected. It's okay with me.
What's okay?
Kate asked.
That we band our towns together for the duration of this crisis?
For what purpose?
Defense, Carl said. We hold the door to the west. You have the one to the east. We cooperate, we survive. We don't, we are all in the deep dip.
Charlie stood up and pointed to the county map pinned to the wall.
We have the bottleneck for I-40 and Route 70 in our town on the east side. That's up just past Exit 66. Just west of Exit 59 there's another bottleneck where the Swannanoa mountain range has a spur that comes down. The two highways, the railroad and the creek, are practically side by side over there in Swannanoa. A defendable position, only a couple of 100 yards wide. We have the front door, they have the back door.
Maybe it's the other way around,
Carl said, a bit of an edge to his voice.
Remember, we are closer to Asheville, and they are still trying to force us to take 5,000 for my town and 5,000 for yours. I'm holding them back, and it's getting ugly real quick. We've had half a dozen deaths at the barrier the last 2 days.
From what?
Keller asked.
Gunshot, that's what,
Carl replied sharply.
There's people that walked down here told they'd find food. We're telling them there ain't none. It's getting bad. I understand it's chaos on Old 70 and the interstate back towards Asheville.
Why in hell didn't those idiots in the county office just tell people to stay in place?
Charlie snapped bitterly. They just started this move even when we told them not to.
Because they want to survive, John said, and the numbers are not adding up.
It'll be a die-off, Keller interjected. A bad one. And Asheville wants it to rest on us, not them. Can't blame them, really.
I sure as hell do, Charlie said coldly.
Well, if you want to keep them out of your backyard, Carl said, then we better get cooperating real quick.
A smart move, John said.
That 60 head of cattle you folks was talking about, if Asheville comes in here, They'll be gone in a day. And then what?
He paused and smiled.
Besides, we've counted over 120 cattle in our town and 300 pigs.
In spite of the horrifying severity of the crisis, John smiled. It truly was like ancient kings negotiating. Carl looked around the room and all were silent. He had played his trump card, and just won with it.
"There's one other back door," Carl finally continued. "That's up by the Haw Creek Road, but we can seal that off as well. Our numbers, you have about 1,000 more people here than we do, not counting all those that already wandered in."
"Will you share the cattle?" Charlie asked.
Carl hesitated, looked over at his companion.
"You have 3 pharmacies in your town. We only had one. You open up your medical supplies to us, we'll consider a transfer of some cattle and pigs."
"Consider?"
Kate asked, and suddenly there was a shrewd look in her eye. Carl looked at Charlie.
"Okay. We'll share them out as needed," Charlie said. "But it's full sharing on both sides, medicine, food, weapons, vehicles, manpower."
Charlie looked around the room, and John caught his eye.
"Governance," John said.
"Go on."
"I'm sorry, folks, but I feel like I'm in an old movie set in medieval or ancient times," John said. "We're like 2 kingdoms here negotiating."
"Well, I guess that's the way it's getting," Doc Keller said. "But Swannanoa does have an outreach clinic from Memorial Mission. We could use that as a medical center. They had some equipment there for minor surgeries, emergencies, and such. Also, 3 or 4 doctors in your town. That would give us a total of 9 doctors for the community."
Carl nodded.
"We protected the clinic from day one. Had the same problem you did with some druggies." He paused. "We shot them when they were trying to escape."
John did not ask for any details on that.
"Governance. We can't be divided off if we agree to work together on this. Everyone is in the same boat.
So, what will it be?"
Charlie looked at Carl.
"I've known you for years, Charlie Fuller. As long as you are not tied into Asheville, I'll be willing to take orders from you."
"Damn, I'll be glad not to have to make some of these decisions."
Charlie nodded.
"Then Carl sits on this council," John said.
"Who are you?"
Carl asked, looking straight at John.
"He's a history professor at the college, ex-military, a colonel with combat experience."
John looked at Charlie. Combat experience, that was stretching it. "He advises us on legal stuff, moral issues. A smart man to have around."
"So why is he here in this meeting?"
Carl asked calmly. John bristled slightly. How he had evolved into being here? Well, it had simply started with his barging in, but now, after but a week, he felt the need to be here, and a purpose.
"He is the one who executed the drug thieves," Tom said. "Let's just say he's our compass. Professor type, but okay."
Carl continued to hold eye contact with John, and he wondered if there was going to be trouble.
"My friend Mike Vance here. Then I want him on this council, too. We didn't have a mayor like you, but he was town manager."
John could see that Vance was someone who did what Carl wanted.
"We're not a democracy here," John said, "though I regret to say that. We are under martial law, and Charlie Fuller is in charge. We just advise. If we are to work together, it has to be Charlie's word that is the final say."
"Nice friend you have, Charlie," Mike said quietly.
"Mike, Carl,"
and now it was Tom speaking,
"we've got to work together, and I agree with John. Either Charlie runs it for all of us, or the deal is off."
The room was filled with silence, and Carl finally nodded. Charlie came around the table, and Carl stood up, shaking his hand. John said nothing. The formal ritual had been played out. The kings had shaken hands, and the treaty been made. It was the smart move, though he wondered if all would feel the same a month, 6 months from now. Charlie went back to his chair and sat down.
With the extra vehicles, I know the answer already, but gas supply?
We just drain it out of all the stalled cars on the highway, for starters, Tom said.
I know that, but should we start rounding that up now?
Wouldn't do that, Mike interjected. Gas goes bad over time. You can't get it out of the gas stations until we rig up some sort of pumps. Inside a car, though, the tank is sealed. It'll stay good in there longer than if we pull it out. I know. I own a wrecking shop.
Like him or not, John realized, this man's knowledge at this moment might be more valuable than his own.
All right, then, Charlie said. Back to Asheville. Carl, you and I both got the same demand from their new director of public safety, Roger Burns. Asshole, Carl said quietly, and Tom nodded in agreement. That we're to take 10,000 refugees in.
He can kiss our asses,
Carl snapped back. 10,000 of those yuppies and hippies, you've got to be kidding. John noted the change the alliance had already created. Now it was we against them. He hoped that would last. The debate flared for several minutes, Kate leaning towards accepting it that these were neighbors as well, that some semblance of order had to be reestablished on a county level, Carl and Tom flatly refusing. John wondered what was going on at this moment down in Winston-Salem, Charlotte, or far bigger cities, Washington, Chicago, New York. Most likely by now millions were pouring out, at best organized in some way, but far more likely in just a chaotic exodus, like a horde of locusts eating their way across the suburban landscapes. At least here, geography played to their advantage, the choke points and the roads. He had already seized on the idea last night. Brilliant in its simplicity, but frightful for all that it implied but 10 days into this crisis. He waited for a pause in the debate.
I have a simple answer, John said, that will defuse the crisis without a confrontation.
I'm all ears, Professor, Carl said sarcastically.
Water.
Water?
Carl asked. But John could already see the flicker of a grin on Carl's face.
Their reservoir is in our territory. The deal is simple. Lay off the pressure. Send their refugees somewhere else or we turn the water off.
Carl looked at him wide-eyed for several seconds, then threw his head back and laughed.
I'll be damned!
I think we are damned if we turn off the water to Asheville,
Doc Keller interjected, and Kate nodded in agreement.
So do I, John said quietly. I don't know if I could actually bring myself to do it. There's 100,000 innocent people there, but this Burns character is playing power politics on us. But we hold the trump card. Send a message back. They still have their water, but send the refugees somewhere else. That simple. No problem for them. If not, we blow the main pipe and the hell with them.
Maybe that might provoke them to try and seize it by force, Kate replied.
John shook his head. No way. Remember the hurricane in 2004? The main pipe out of the reservoir ruptured, and it was one hell of a mess. Special parts had to be flown in from outside the state to repair it. Well, after that, they know how vulnerable the water supply is. We make it clear that if they make a move, we blow it, and they'll never get it back online.
If we got that advantage, let's press it, Carl said. I've heard they got dozens of railroad cars loaded with food and are hoarding it for themselves. We could demand some of that as well.
Not a bad idea, Tom said quietly. You might be onto something there.
I'm not reduced to that yet, Kate snapped back. Trading water for food? Not yet.
Nor I. Just keep it to the refugee problem. I think if we demand a cut of their supplies, they'll fight. And remember, they do have the numbers we don't have, John quickly interjected, and we'll wind up losers. But regarding the refugees, let's just say we'll make them an offer they can't refuse, Charlie smiled.
That's right. You're from New Jersey originally, John smiled. They back off in the refugee issue, and that water just keeps flowing.
Charlie looked around the table and all nodded. Tom? Send a courier back today. Use one of those mopeds we got running.
I don't want to risk a car the way we did the other day.
A pleasure, Charlie. Wish I could see Burns' face when he gets the note.
Just remember this, though, Charlie replied.
Our sewage runs to the treatment plant in Asheville. The filtration is most likely not running. Chances are they're dumping it straight into the French Broad, but still, if they close the pipe, it backs up clear to our town here. They could shut that down in retaliation.
Then we threaten to dump our raw sewage right into Swannanoa Creek, which runs downhill to Asheville, Tom replied.
Jesus Christ, Keller sighed. Are we getting reduced to this?
No one could reply.
All right, Charlie said. The big issue. Our roadblock on I-40 at the top of the gap.
He looked at Tom.
It's getting bad there. Like we agreed to yesterday, I had someone take a note down to Old Fort at the bottom of the mountain asking them to post a sign that the road above was closed. Old Fort refused. They've got 7, maybe 10,000 refugees camped there, all of them trying to get up into these mountains. They want us to let the people pass. In fact, they're encouraging them to hike up the interstate and, if need be, force their way through. The pressure is building. There's refugees strung out all along the highway. Last night, one of my men shot and killed two of them.
What? Kate snapped. I didn't hear of this.
Figured I'd bring it up this morning, Tom said.
What happened?
A crowd of about 50 just would not turn back. The men guarding the gap said they recognized several as folks who had been turned back earlier. They planned what they did and tried to rush us. Someone on their side tried to shoot, and my men fired back. Two dead on their side, about a dozen wounded.
Kate shook her head.
It's going to get worse, Tom said. Remember what Mr. Barber said when he flew up here last week? The interstate clogged with refugees pouring out of Charlotte and Winston-Salem? Well, Charlotte is 110 miles from here, Winston-Salem about 140. Give a family burdened down with stuff about 10 to 15 miles a day. That means the real wave is going to start hitting us today. I'm surprised it hasn't been sooner. We might find 20, 30, maybe 50,000 pushing up that road.
Why, I wanted this alliance, Carl said. You're our back door. You let them in, we will be swamped. We'll be caught between Asheville on the one side and those folks on the other. They'll eat us clean in a day.
Disease as well, Keller interjected.
I thought you said we had that already, Carl asked.
Keller sighed and shook his head.
Salmonella, that's lurking in any community. I'm talking about the exotics now. Large urban population, you'll have carriers of hepatitis in every variant. What scares the hell out of me is a recent immigrant from overseas or someone stranded at the airport in Charlotte, which is a major hub. He might look well and feel well, but inside he might be carrying typhoid, cholera, you name it. We got one of those in a crowd, giving sanitation for those people walking here. Just simple hand contact, or fecal-to-water supply, or food distribution supply contact, and that bacteria will jump. We give someone a plate of food, they haven't washed their hands, we don't clean that plate with boiling water, and within a week, thousands will be sick and dying.
You ever seen cholera? Keller asked. No one spoke.
I did. 30 years back. A mission trip to Africa. It makes Salmonella look tame. People in those regions, most of them were exposed to it at some point in their lives and survived. We're wide open to it. We are 6, 7 generations removed from it. And we have no natural immunity. America is like an exotic hothouse plant. It can only live now in the artificial environment of vaccinations, sterilization, and antibiotics we started creating 100 or more years ago. We're about to get reintroduced to life as it is now in Africa, or most of the Third World. Not counting the global flu outbreak of 1918, the last really big epidemic, one that killed off a fair percentage of a population in a matter of weeks, well, I think it was the Chicago typhoid epidemic back in the 1880s that killed tens of thousands. Water supply got polluted with typhoid and they died like flies. that made the famous fire pale in comparison when it came to body count.
Inoculations? Charlie asked.
Well, Keller said with a cynical laugh.